Please remember that you are to give a warm welcome out in Fellowship Hall this morning to Connie Wolfe. 1933 was a good year, but I think when you see Connie, you'll know that she had very little to do with it. Two of us who belong to this church were talking the other day about unpleasant surprises, and he said, "You want to know what always frightens me half to death? It's when the telephone rings at 2 or 3 in the morning." I knew, and we all know, what he meant. That startling and insistent alarm that rips into sound sleep and scares us wide awake, heart pounding. We wish we didn't have to answer, because it's never Ed McMahon. But we're afraid not to answer, so we pick up the phone and try to sound relaxed, as if we often get phone calls at 2 in the morning. If it's a local call, it says something like this: "I remember. Dad, I'm out here on Windmill Road. I poured gas into the carburetor to start it, and it caught fire, and the whole car has burned up." Or, as it also happened once when we lived in a parsonage: "Sir, are you aware that your garage is on fire?" If the call is long distance, the news is likely to be even more alarming. The illness is suddenly much worse. There's been an accident. But in either case, we've been summoned to make some kind of response. Ministers speak of being called to their profession. We are all being called, long distance and otherwise, every day of our lives. Thank God it isn't always a call of alarm. You walk along an empty beach at sunset, as I did once on a lonely stretch of the Pacific, and a seagull wheels and veers in the gray wind. And there is something so wild and lovely about it that it too becomes a voice calling, and you have to paint it into a picture or sing it into a song, or, as I did, write it into a poem. Or if you can't respond in any of those ways, then in some other way you have to be true to that little scrap of wonder you have seen. Or somebody drags you off one day to Heart Spring, or to a special school for retarded children, where you've been mailing a neat, clean check by long-distance charity, and you get to know one of the kids, so that when you come back the next time, that child comes running up to you as if you were Christmas morning. And then it's like that phone ringing in the night, or the seagull riding the saltwater wind. A voice has called. There is a summons you have to answer somehow, or else pay the cost of not answering. It may happen to you the way it did to Isaiah from the Bible, who says that in the year a certain king died, he had his vision and heard a voice saying, "Whom shall I send?" And before he quite knew what he was doing, perhaps, Isaiah answered, "Here I am, send me." And the voice in his vision said, "Go," and his life changed forever. But more likely, in these days, such calls may come from a great speech, or a novel, or an extraordinary movie. I'm waiting eagerly to see Schindler's List, because I was told last week by a man I trust that it is an astonishing, transforming film, the kind of experience that actually changes your life, that calls you to do or be something better than you have been. We are called like that often in the course of a lifetime. Sometimes we accept quickly. Sometimes we resist for a long time. Sometimes forever. And then something dies in us. The Bible is honest, as always, about how we resist. Moses complained when he was called to leadership that he couldn't talk well enough. Jeremiah shrank from the role of prophet, arguing that he was not smart enough. "I am a child," he said, and looked around for someone else to do it. Paul heard a voice in his vision that said, "It is not easy for you to feel the sting of your conscience, is it?" And the history of the world for the next 2,000 years hung in the balance. I hope that by now, if I remind you of the Apostle Paul's remark on this very subject, it will have a special meaning. God, he says, has called us to a dedicated life, not for any merit of ours, but for his own purpose and his own grace. It can be hard sometimes to know what that purpose is. But I believe as strongly as I believe anything that the happiest people in this room or anywhere are those with a sense of having been called to do something or be something and a sense of having tried very hard to respond. There's a rather sad little game we play at times when we reach a certain age. We get out the old class yearbook, look at friends we knew, think about all the exciting, crazy things those classmates used to be interested in, and the dreams they had of what they would do when they graduated. And then we sit pondering what some of these people actually did with their lives. Sad because some of them did not listen to the voice that was right for them and have lived a long time without joy or pride in what they do, knowing they had gifts that they were never quite willing to lay on the altar because the wrong voices were louder than the right ones. I was moved at one time early in my life by reading a novel called Point of No Return, which tells how, after many years of apple polishing and bucking for promotion, the chief character, Charlie Gray, finally gets to be vice president of the fancy little New York bank where he works. And then the terrible moment comes when he realizes it is really not what he wants after all, when the prize he has spent his life trying to win turns to ashes in his hands. The family he has neglected now has all the security it needs of a kind, But you end by thinking that the best way Charlie could have supported his family would have been by giving his life to the kind of work that would have fulfilled him and made him become, in himself, the kind of support they all most needed. For some other men, that vice presidency might have been the right job. For Charlie, it wasn't. It had cost him too much. It had blotted out the sound of other calls, which he knew all along made more sense. There is a great moment in the Gospels when Jesus goes into the desert to brood on his future and to conquer the temptations that parade through his head about how to enter that future. One of them is to turn stones into bread. That is, to make his great talents serve mainly the material needs of his poor neighbors. His response is classic, and only our familiarity with it can blind us to the fact that it's one of the truest of all great declarations. Humanity, he said, shall not live by bread alone. Isn't it ironic that in the hippie subculture, bread came to mean money, and that the long-haired carpenter's son, determining his future in the desert, said, "We do not live by bread alone"? Please don't dismiss that as no more than church talk, moralistic and sentimental. It means simply that we have to be careful with our lives because they are the only ones we will get in this puzzling and perilous world, and what we do with them matters enormously. And I'm sure that John Marquand was right in his novel by suggesting that for each of us, as for Charlie Gray, there comes a point of no return, a point at which we no longer have life enough left to go back and start all over again. So we have to listen with care to the voices we hear, the calls that come, long distance and otherwise. I should probably warn you now about something, especially if you are the romantic type. You may be tempted to think that God has not called you unless the voice is exotic and the task is fascinating, and better yet, in some remote place with white sand, green palms, and blue lagoons, that it is foolish to see one's life as truly dedicated when one is an electronics repairman or a saleswoman or a dentist or a mother. This is the mistake a woman made in one of Charles Dickens' novels. She spends her whole life planning great projects for the natives of Africa, while right under her feet, people are dying for lack of simple kindness and care. In her eyes, Dickens says, there's always a far-off look, as if she cannot see anything closer than Africa. Her home is unbelievably untidy. Her dress is slovenly. Her children are lost half the time and hungry for food and love the other half, but she never notices. She writes letters and makes plans to educate the natives of Borabulaga on the banks of the Niger River until one of her children, older than the other, says one day, "I wish Africa was dead." I have a couple of convictions about how to be happy. And even if they sound trite, I will risk exposing them. First, don't look so far ahead that you never notice all there is to do at your feet. Don't be tuned in only to far-off voices and never hear the one speaking softly at your elbow. And the second thing is, believe that what you do is important, and then do it with all the energy and joy you can muster. Believe that at this moment in life, it is your call to do this thing, and that if you do it with a whole and happy heart, as if called by God to do it, it will either become richer in itself or it will lead on to other tasks of greater importance yet. That is not idle talk to fill out a sermon. I really believe it. I'm sure that the oddest thing I would say to you at the tail end of all these words is that when it comes right down to it, the vocation, the calling of all of us is to be saviors ourselves. Now, the word may frighten us half to death, but it's actually what Christianity insists on. And it's a challenging and noble idea that cannot be completely cheapened, no matter how foolish the church may sometimes look, no matter how futile our lives may sometimes seem. I do not mean by Savior, God forbid, that we should dash around with a Messiah complex. One David Koresh per decade is more than enough. But that we come with healing, with whatever gladness we have, among whatever men and women we are called to work with, to turn our work into a sacrament, believing that somehow it counts, that if we do it well, it makes a difference, that this is our calling, that this is our vocation, that this is the destiny to which we were summoned because of what we are and what the moment needs from us. We need not feel disappointed if we had no decisive or dramatic call. Sometimes we drift imperceptibly into the task that is exactly right for us. And there is no drama or high romance about it. Yet in a way, we are each where we are this morning because we listened to voices from inside or outside, and it all started when we chose to follow one of them. A profession, a marriage, a church where the rites of passage are celebrated and a sense of wonder and obligation instilled in us on Sundays. If you are still listening to voices, be careful to remember that life leads on from the moment of your answering. And just in case now I've missed you with this whole thing, let me leave you with a question that can't miss. It was expressed once by a man named Christopher Morley, and it goes like this. If we discovered that we had 5 minutes to say all we wanted to say, every telephone booth would be occupied by people calling other people to stammer that they love them. So why wait until the last 5 minutes? Why indeed, when all of us in some way or other call out to know if somebody loves us? Because beyond the business, beyond the games we play, the ultimate question is that. So the calls we get and how we answer them, the calls we make and what they do for other people, not many things in your life will be more important. So stay tuned.